Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to the 22nd Bitcoin Standard Podcast Seminar. In today's seminar, our guest is Tone Vays, a market analyst in the cryptocurrency space. If I wanted to tease him, I'd say it that way, but he is obviously an analyst in the Bitcoin space, and he's somebody who's spent a lot of time looking at Bitcoin over the last few years and whose analysis has been quite informative and enjoyable. Tone is also a trader, and he is somebody that I have discussed an interesting question with over the years, which is the question of trading, and in particular, is trading bullshit? And so today we're going to be talking to Tone about trading, and in particular trading from the perspective of Bitcoin. Should Bitcoiners be thinking about trading? Should they not? What kind of trading matters? And, I'm going to put my cards on the table from the beginning and say that I'm generally skeptical of the idea that you should be trading. But that will hopefully make for an interesting discussion with Tone. So, Tone, is trading bullshit?
Well, no, trading is not bullshit, but it's not for everyone. I think the closest thing to trading is real gambling, and there is gambling that is simply more of a probabilistic gambling. Obviously, flipping a coin is probabilistic gambling, but even something like blackjack. Blackjack is a very odds-focused game, Sure, you can count cards, but I was actually just in Vegas the other day, and I don't gamble much, just for fun. And I happened to sit down at this blackjack table with someone that's from Vegas, and he noticed, and he's like, "Hey, Tone, you realize you're playing at a blackjack table where there's shuffling going on between every hand in the machine. So if there's shuffling between every hand in the machine, then the ability to count cards in a blackjack game doesn't give you any advantage. You're simply playing the odds. You have a seven deck shoe, and it reshuffles between every hand. And people still go and play blackjack knowing that the dealer has an advantage of like 1 to 2%, and they kind of do it for fun. So that kind of game is strictly, you know, almost 50-50. You can have a feeling, but you can't really read the other player. But in a game like poker, there's a lot of professional poker players and there's a lot of amateur poker players, but people kind of know that going to play poker, there's a high probability you will lose your money, especially to a player that is a professional. But anyone can be a professional poker player, and there's lots of them. So to me, trading, like real trading, is akin to playing poker. And the more diligent you are, the more disciplined you are, the more you study, the better the odds are in your favor that you could succeed. But most people don't want to put in the work. And that is why they end up very disappointed. And just because you do put in the work, it doesn't mean you're going to be successful. So if you don't think playing poker is like bullshit, then trading isn't either.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the problem I would say with both playing poker and trading is ultimately that they're not productive activities. That would be the case against it. You're not really producing anything. You're just betting on cards falling in a certain way, or in trading, you know, you're betting on market prices happening between people that are actually engaging in actual production. So, you know, people are buying and selling commodities, but traders are there speculating that, you know, there's going to be a spike in demand for this thing and a spike in supply of that thing. And so they're speculating on it, and if they make money, they make money. If not, it's just gambling. But I don't think that that is true for trading entirely, because in regular markets, you know, if you're speculating on iron and coal and oil and other commodities, and you happen to make money, you know, you're not just gambling. Your money, you only manage to make money by allocating capital correctly in the market. And that means moving capital from places where it is not desired to places where it is desired. So if you manage to predict correctly trends in the price of oil, and you buy at a certain time and you sell at another time, and you make a profit, that means that you bought at a time when oil was cheap, and so you took oil from a place where it was cheap and sold at a time when it was expensive. And so you helped effectively bridge the gap between those two prices, and you're helping smooth the market, and you're helping allocate the resources from a place where they're in excess to places where they are where they're in more demand. So it's perhaps, you know, not exactly quite like gambling, even if people come at it with the perspective of it being gambling. But I think in trading in general, you are kind of you are engaging in capital allocation. Would you say so?
Well, yeah, and that's a really good point, because you're right. Playing poker is not very productive to society. And I use that argument sometimes when at conferences, I'm sure you hear all the time, when people say, well, Bitcoin burns all this electricity unnecessarily. And when I hear this from young people, my favorite argument against it, instead of trying to, you know, explain the economic model of it, which you did very elegantly and very quickly in the book, but it was perfect in a single paragraph, I ask them if they play video games. Because the amount of electricity being burned by the world playing video games is probably still bigger than Bitcoin mining. And what productivity does video games bring, you know, to advance the world? So that's kind of my view on it. Well, if you're going to blame Bitcoin for burning electricity, what about all the people who play video games? So one of the biggest functions of a capitalistic stock market is it gives you price discovery of an asset. And this is where, you know, I get into a little bit of a hot water with some libertarians and some Austrian economists, where I think that, you know, there is a function to an organization like the SEC. They're not doing a very good job, and I think it's a horrible, you know, government entity. But the idea of it is, you know, it's not that bad, because I hate it when, you know, like Ponzi schemes are out there trying to get price discovery. So I do believe that your asset that's trying to get price discovery has to have legitimacy in the market. And we can spend, you know, an entire week debating what is and isn't legitimate in the market, but we also know the crypto space as to how many illegitimate projects there are that are trying to claim to be legitimate. And it's obvious to some of us that they're not. So as long as you have a legitimate asset, and obviously gold and oil are legitimate assets, and then the function of this free market and trading just helps to identify a true market price. And that is what a capitalistic system is all about. But it is hard to, in some fringe cases, it's hard to identify whether the asset is legit and should be allowed to be traded by the general public. And I guess this is more of a philosophical debate. It'll turn into a philosophical debate. But yeah, you are right on that. And it is a necessary function. Now, the majority of traders around the world, this is the other thing that people don't realize, the majority of traders around the world are fundamental analyst traders. The big funds, they're not looking at moving averages. They're not looking at candlesticks. They don't do what I do. The people that are at home traders looking, trying to read charts or trying to read the tea leaves, this is still a small percentage of traders. I mean, these traders didn't barely existed 100 years ago when the markets were already pretty functional in Amsterdam, in the UK, in the US. And technical and analysts were few and far between. Now, the number of technical analysts is slowly increasing, but it's still a small minority. And the majority of people do research. But my view is the average person at home doesn't have the resources to do the research of a fund. I have relatives that work at a fund. They hire interns. They literally put an intern to research a company for weeks. One company. They may send them out there. They may send them and like park them in front of Home Depot and just like count cars. Like, this is something that you can't do. And the majority of these big institutions, they do this advanced research. And they're buying into these things in large quantities for longer term investments. And then small traders at home are trying to piggyback of what the big guys are doing based on certain chart patterns. So it really depends on what kind of trading you're doing before you can say whether trading is useful, bad, good, gambling or not.
Well, I think, I mean, from market's perspective, if you're managing to put money somewhere and you're finding another person on the other end of that trade, then, you know, all value is subjective. And so you're giving your counterparty in that trade their money's worth. If you're not putting a gun to their head, if it's not fiat, you know, if you're not a government forcing people to trade with you, then people are only trading because they want to. And so in a sense, it's peaceful, and it's capital allocation. And of course, you may personally, I at least think that, you know, there's an enormous amount of waste that subjectively people waste a lot of time and money doing that. But, you know, from an economic perspective, as an economist, I can't look at that and say this is good or bad. I, you know, as you say, price discovery is just, it's out there and it's happening. And, you know, some people need to discover the fact that they're just not good at holding capital and allocating it. And it's a sad reality that it has to happen this way. But, you know, I think The reality of it is that while it is useful and it is valuable, I don't see it as something that people should be doing on the side. And I don't think of it as something that people should be doing to supplement their income, because I think you simply have no chance against the pros. You have no chance against the people that are much more liquid. And you know, you're likely wasting your time if you're doing if you think that you're going to outsmart the market. And I think it's where I can find maybe the strongest argument against it being productive or being good, or the strongest reasons for telling people to avoid it might just be the fact that in this current monetary system, where everything is basically being measured with a broken money. So it's like you're doing engineering with an elastic meter. The meter band or the measuring tape that you're using is elastic. And so anything can be 1 inch long or 1 foot long or 10 feet long. Depending on how much you stretch the elastic measuring tape, you'll get different measurements. And so in that kind of market setting, that creates an enormous amount of volatility, creates an enormous amount of just dislocation between fundamentals and market price, because there's no real scarcity to money, and there's no real opportunity cost to allocating money incorrectly, because the people who are able to access money are able to access enormous quantities of it, and so can continue to make mistakes with allocation and can continue to misallocate and continue to be protected from the consequences of it. And so because of this, I think, you know, the fiat system makes trading so common because it essentially it essentially ruins the money, and it ruins our ability to trade with a good medium of account, and therefore we're constantly in this this mathematical mess where people are trying to figure out prices and trying to allocate resources, but everything is constantly shifting because it's effectively like trying to build houses on quicksand with an elastic band, to mix metaphors together. But what do you think in terms of, or sorry, do you have something to add about that?
Yeah, so look, I agree with you. I don't think trading is a good way to supplement your income, unless it really depends on the kind of job that you have. For example, a fireman that works 12-hour shifts 3 days a week does have a full day, a couple of days a week to fully allocate to that. So it depends on your job. It depends how much free time you have. But most of the time, I don't recommend being a trader for real money with a day job. It becomes very, very challenging. You usually end up not paying attention to your job. You're sitting there with a cell phone watching the market. The less free time you have, the higher your time frame should be and the less trades you should do. So, for example, you could come up with strategies that are on a longer term time horizon, like on weekly charts, where you're allocating your 401k, for example. And as long as you're disciplined and you have tested your methods, you certainly could see the market turning with something as simple as moving averages of the price. So they could get you out. Maybe not right at the top of, you know, 2008 when the market topped, but maybe a few weeks after that, maybe a month after that. And you could have gotten back in based on the same methods, you know, not right at the low when the market bottomed in March of 2009, but maybe 2 or 3 months later. A trader could, you know, review the charts on the weekends and not pay attention to the day-to-day fluctuations. Now, of course, you would also have to be trading assets that are within themselves some kind of an average. You don't want to trade, you know, the hottest IPO, or perhaps you may not want to trade Bitcoin. But if you wanted to allocate something like this to the S&P 500, that has already removed the risk of a catastrophic you know, bankruptcy or, you know, a CEO blunder or, you know, a company turning out to be an Enron, you can remove that by using strategies on a longer term basis on more of an average. Also, if you're like I've been a big believer in Tesla for years. I've been talking about it on my channel for a long time. Now, I didn't allocate a portfolio to Tesla. I prefer Bitcoin. I know the fundamentals of Bitcoin better than I know the fundamentals of Tesla because I live and breathe Bitcoin. I don't, you know, analyze Tesla's books all day long. But I've been talking about Tesla forever, and Tesla outbeat Bitcoin in 2020. Tesla doubled or tripled Bitcoin's returns in 2020, even with this latest rise. So if you were a believer in Tesla, allocating a portion of your portfolio to Tesla would not have been a bad choice, because that it was actually too obvious and it still outperformed. I remember tweeting out, I got on an airplane in February. I do a bad job of taking my own advice, but I got on an airplane in February flying from the Philippines to LA. And, you know, the COVID was already a problem. Like, I didn't take it seriously. After I got to LA in February, I went to Mexico, and then we did the conference. You were there. And then I flew out to Africa. But even in February, like, we saw the effects of COVID getting on that airplane. And from the airplane, just as it was taking off for the 14-hour flight, I tweeted, based on my experience at that airport, I tweeted, might not be a bad time to get out or short airlines and buy something like Zoom. But then I was on a 14-hour flight. I landed. I had a couple of days in LA, meetings, and then an event in Mexico, and then my conference. So I never actually bothered to go and enter these types of general macro trades. Then Zoom does 5X and airlines crash 50% over the next few months. So you can see the trends, and I think trading is possible, but you have to take it seriously. It's not easy. And if you do have a day job, you cannot be a day trader. You can't overtrade. You have to look at the bigger picture, and you can also do it for fun with a small part of your account. You don't have to, you know, you can't bet the house on every trade. But if you really have an itch for trading, just trade with 10% of your portfolio. And if that 10% starts doing better and better and better, you know that maybe this could be something you enjoy more. In my case, when I did eventually quit my job and was a full-time trader, I quit in order to be a trader, to be my own boss and enjoy life and not have to answer to anyone and work from anywhere and enjoy it. And then what I ended up doing for like a year and a half or 2 years is like stuck in front of like three monitors, and I wasn't really enjoying life being a trader. But everything, all the reasons for quitting my job and becoming a trader were fulfilled doing what I do now, traveling, speaking about Bitcoin, enjoying it. So I'm happy that I quit my job to be a full-time trader. And at the same time, I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I would, but it allowed me to do something else with the same lifestyle that I thought I was getting. But that's a special case. You can always try it with a little bit, as long as you understand the reality of the situation.
I think maybe the best argument that can be made for trading is that whether you like it or not, you are trading at every moment. You know, not trading is a trade in itself. And so you're constantly allocated. If you own anything, then you are choosing to trade and to allocate in different places. And I think, whereas, you know, I don't recommend it as a full-time job. And maybe, you know, playing around with the 10% is probably not not exactly all that interesting or important. I think perhaps the most useful aspect of it is that if you could learn the basics enough so that you can use it to help your risk management of your regular investments, I think this might be really the best case for why, you know, the average Joe should at least learn a little bit about it. What do you think?
Yeah, see, there's a catch-22 there a little bit, because the best way to actually hedge your risk is with some very advanced tools, like options and futures. And these are highly leveraged instruments. And they are incredible means of hedging and lowering your risk. But at the same time, they are some of the most dangerous, high leveraged portfolio wrecking tools when they are used to speculate on the market instead of their actual intention for creation to be lowering the risk of your portfolio. Yes. So most of those tools are just advanced, and you need to go into them with the mindset of using them to lower the risk of your portfolio, not increase it. And most people either don't get to learning them or start learning them for the wrong reasons. And that's how a lot of people get in trouble.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddine.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, I see. So it's basically not very easy to just learn enough to, you know, manage the risk of your portfolio, because it's like a highly sophisticated piece of equipment. You're either good enough to drive the space rocket or you're not. You can't know just how to drive it well enough so that you can take it to shopping, you know?
Right.
There's no driving the Concorde to the grocery store. If you're gonna drive it, it's gonna require the same level of skill and expertise. Is that how you would say?
Right. No, that's another great example. And when people, you know, when people give me a lot of shit for teaching trading, I also kind of, I analogies are never great, but I use the same analogy of driving a car. You don't just get behind a wheel of a car. Like, someone has to teach you how to drive a car. And learning how to drive a car from Google or from free resources is not a good idea, a car or any other mechanical vehicle. Like, you need to learn it from someone who's experienced. Now, the problem now becomes, who do you learn from? Because if you learn to drive from a bad driver, maybe you were better off learning it from Google. And this is a little bit of a challenge. And when it comes to trading, you can take it one step further, you know, driving a race car. Like, at which point does a driver become a race car driver, which is a very dangerous profession? And who teaches them? Because someone has to, like, even Tiger Woods has a golfing coach, right? Like who's Tiger Woods' golfing coach? And when you say, well, how are you going to learn from this guy? He doesn't even play golf. It's like, yeah, but he's teaching Tiger Woods something. Same thing with race car drivers. And it's usually former race car drivers, some of them who are good teachers, and some of the best traders are not good teachers. And you'll find that a lot of good teachers were not great traders, but they can be good teachers of trading because they know the fundamentals and they know the rules. But there is certainly a lot of snake oil in this business. So learning who to learn from is also a big, big challenge. Because if they teach you the wrong way, you're going to get yourself in trouble.
Yeah, and you know, again, I reiterate my position that you should probably avoid trading. It contradicts what I said about everybody being a trader, but I think in general, you know, if you think, well, I'm just going to go and trade and make money, it's pretty risky. I wouldn't recommend risking money.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. And I even, Sazan interrupted you, but I even say the same thing about Bitcoin lately. Because a lot of people want to get into Bitcoin now that it's a bull market. And I tell them that if you are going to buy Bitcoin for the sole purpose of making money, you're going to be disappointed even if you make money. Because if you don't understand Bitcoin and you're buying Bitcoin and then it doubles in price and you sell it because you met your goal of making money, you're going to be very disappointed in the future if it keeps going up. And if you bought at the wrong time and it falls on you, you're going to be also disappointed. Like there's no way you're going to come out of a Bitcoin investment happy 5 years down the line unless you understood the fundamentals of Bitcoin. And trading is kind of similar. If you're going into it just to make money, you're going to find out how challenging it really is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's no joke. And I think the horrible thing about fiat is that it forces everybody to become a bit of a trader when in a fiat world you are always trading because there's no stable foundation for a fiat economy. Under a gold standard, in a sense, holding gold was a trade, but there was the one trade that everybody had been conditioned to do for thousands and thousands of years, and everybody knew how to do it, and it is hold gold for the future. And you could just do that, and you would reliably expect that the gold would appreciate by a small percentage every year. And that was it. You didn't have to speculate on it. You didn't have to hedge your position in gold. You didn't have to have exposure to bonds and commodities and foreign stock markets and indices and so on. You didn't have to study all these kind of strange financial instruments. You just held gold. And that allowed people to specialize in their own jobs. You know, you earned gold and you put it aside, then you focused on being a brain surgeon. You earned gold, you put it aside, and you focused on being a taxi driver or a physicist or whatever it is. And you could focus on that, and you could know that, you know, the money that you earn is always going to be there for you. Unfortunately, with fiat, this is no longer the case. There's just nothing that you can use as the basis of your portfolio that you could save into and expect it to be there for you in the future. So you can't just hold fiat because it would depreciate, and you can't just hold gold because it's really expensive to go in and out of it. And so you have to, if you're thinking about value preservation for the future, you should get exposure to gold. If you're thinking about using something as cash in the present day that's going to involve a lot of transactions, you would want to hold fiat. But neither of these is good enough really to beat inflation, because in real terms, in terms of rare goods and services and scarce goods and services, inflation usually beats the appreciation in the price of gold. And so if you want to keep up, you need to get your money to work. You need to make returns. And so you need to start speculating on things, and then you're forced to trade. So I think as much as you might have problems with the trade, I think we have to sort of, with trading, I think you have to kind of understand that in a fiat system, people are sort of forced into having to trade, because otherwise you just witness your wealth getting robbed. But having said that, the amazing thing about a Bitcoin world is that we're getting back to not having to trade. So I can see the case for trading, but I think the case for just stacking sats is far more compelling. You will do better. And I think, you know, there's no trader that can reliably beat stacking sats over a very long over a long time period.
I completely agree. I know a lot of people, they have some Bitcoin and they want to make a return on their Bitcoin. I always advise them against that because Bitcoin is just too valuable. And that measly 6% you're trying to get by letting anyone else hold your Bitcoin, to me, is just not worth it. And people still have this problem of, well, just my Bitcoin is going up, but I need to do something with it. And that's like, you know, 50 years of or more of mentality that you have to do something with it. And it's really hard to get rid of. It really, really is.
It's the fiat mindset of just constantly thinking that you're on a treadmill.
Yeah, and exactly.
You take the mouse off the treadmill and they still have to run, you know? Even if it's aimless, but they're just running around.
So I just don't advise that. And the beauty about Bitcoin is that it has been going up at an amazing percentage rate since its creation. And I think it has, you know, a lot more to go before it slows down. Because when you were talking about gold, when people are like, you know, working and putting it in gold, gold has been a terrible investment for the last 100 years. Putting your money in the stock market, just in the S&P or the Dow Jones, has absolutely crushed gold. And that's been that buy and hold mentality, which actually, you know, was not that bad, as long as you can hold it for the long term. Because in something like S&P 500 or the Dow, you know, bad companies leave, new, better companies come in. Tesla is entering the S&P 500. One day it might enter the Dow. And unlike gold, which only keeps up with inflation, stock barely, but stock market keeps up with inflation and innovation, because poor companies leave, new companies come in. And Bitcoin has been beating the returns of the S&P 500. So it's becoming a better, it's an amazing combination of both. It's an amazing store of value. I do believe it's the future of money. And dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin has been your best investment. I can try and do screen share real quick. I know this is an audio podcast, but it's just
We've got video as well for members.
Okay. But it's just a chart of dollar cost averaging. And this is by my friend, Ugly Old Goat. You know him as well. And he purposely cherry picked one of the worst times to start dollar cost averaging, January 2014, the start of the 2-year long bear market of 2013. And he's just dollar cost averaging $500 into Bitcoin every month. And you can see what happens right now at the end of 2020.
I'm going to guess $5 million.
No, $1 million. After
500 a week or 500 a month?
500 a month, sorry.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Right, 500
a month. I did something similar and it came out with 100 a month, it came out to 100 a week, it came out to $1 million a month.
Yeah.
Million total, yeah.
And 500 a month, 42,000 invested over the 6-year period. And you're now turned your 42,000, sorry, into 1 million. And he purposely picked the worst time to dollar cost average. Now it was back in 2014. You can do the same exercise. The next worst time to invest would have been January 2018 or December 2017, let's say. You could have started there. And right now you are probably getting to break even. And you're about, I think the future is bright for 2021. So dollar cost averaging is not a bad idea. The challenge is getting into Bitcoin and keeping it secure.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, the amazing thing about Bitcoin as hard money, like it is a trade, but it's just one very simple trade. So you are trading if you're dollar cost averaging, but it is just one simple trade. It's the simple trade, and it is a trade with almost infinite upside. You know, it's not a trade that's going to get crowded out in a couple of years. It's not the stock that can... that can become overvalued. You can't really overvalue Bitcoin because Bitcoin has no returns. So companies are valued based on their returns, but Bitcoin is a monetary asset, so it doesn't have returns you can value it against. What it does have is just monetary premium that accumulates when people want to hold it. And so you expect that if you expect that Bitcoin is going to continue to grow as a monetary asset, which I think seems pretty compelling as a case, as you know, written a book about it, It's a no-brainer because it's just going to continue to go up, and also it's extremely volatile, so it's very, very hard to be able to time the Bitcoin market, and extremely volatile in the way in which, you know, it's I think this is what a lot of people who think they're going to trade Bitcoin miss, which is that you know, it's not like you make a mistake and you lose a little bit of Bitcoin and you lose a little bit of money. Where I was trading and I thought that we were going to go down, and so I sold and then it went up. But with Bitcoin, because it's almost like a one-way bullet up and it gets these massive rises, that if you miss one of these very quick rises because you're not in Bitcoin during that time, you know, you may never be able to buy Bitcoin at that price again. And then you just commit, you know, you miss a significant chunk of it. And so you can see that Bitcoin just has these large rips in price, which I think happen when there's a liquidity squeeze in the market because the supply is becoming short. And then there's a big liquidity squeeze where price spikes up and then stabilizes. And if you miss these, you know, you will, if you miss these because you were trading out of Bitcoin because you thought that it was going to go down, the effect can be quite significant. Each one of these can be a very big hit. So if you add them up and you compare them to just stacking, they really do add up, because when you're stacking, you're buying every dip and you're fully allocated, ready for every rip. And so you end up basically outperforming pretty much anybody if you just stack small amounts of Bitcoin, or obviously not necessarily small, but if you stack regular amounts of Bitcoin at regular intervals and then add them up over time, they add up in a way that I think beats any trading. And I think there's a couple of websites, DCA BTC, I think one of them is called, mm-hmm. That shows you a calculator for differences of how much you could have been stacking and how much money you would have put in and how much money you would have today. So yeah, starting in late 2013, I remember, so 7 years from now, if in the last 7 years you'd put in about $100 a month, it would be worth around $1 million today. You'd have spent about $35,000, I think, and it would be worth around $1 million today. So there's enormous potential in that trade that really makes it far more attractive than any kind of trading course. Like if you look over the last 5 years, stacking Bitcoin has beaten almost every trader's returns, I think. You know, there will be very few traders who will tell you in fiat or Bitcoin that they could manage to beat the returns that you could have gotten if you had just DCA'd. And that's the real lesson to keep in mind, I think, for the vast majority of people. So if you have a job going, if you have a way of securing income, then DCA just is the peace of mind that allows you to focus on that. So that allows you to just focus on your job, excel at your job, earn as much money as you can in your job, and then you don't have to trade, you don't have to do technical analysis, you don't have to do fundamental analysis, you just keep stacking sats and watch them appreciate.
No, I agree. And look, 90% of traders fail. So of course, dollar cost average is going to beat out, since 90% of traders fail. It's not for everyone. And one of my biggest mistakes was quitting my job in early 2015 as Bitcoin continued its bear market for the rest of the year. And I no longer have fiat income. And instead, I was building out my businesses and I was trading. But as I'm trading, I have to live on something. So instead of being able to have a very high paying job, buying more Bitcoin. And I also started a business around that time, and that business was actually costing me money because it was a mistake going into a physical business when I was already a Bitcoiner. So those were my biggest mistakes that prevented me from stacking at a very good price of $200 to $300 a Bitcoin. And in fact, I had to sell some at those prices in order to just continue what I was doing with my businesses. And that was probably my biggest mistake and my biggest regret of what happened in 2015 at the bottom end of that bear market. So don't ever underestimate if income is coming in and you can buy sats with it until eventually you're no longer happy with that job. And then you have to do something else. When I got that Wall Street job, I was so happy to get it. It was my first Wall Street job. It got me out of teaching. I was making about to make good money. And I asked the guy who I was replacing, because he just wanted to leave. And I asked him, why was he quitting? He was probably getting paid close to $250,000. I was replacing him for like 80 grand or something, because he was there for a while. And he basically said, when your commute to work becomes more enjoyable than your work, it's time to move on and do something else. And what he said stuck with me. And 9 years later, that's exactly what I did. I just wish I did it 1 year later, because I would have been able to stack a lot of sats back then.
Yeah, I think this is ultimately the bar that everybody needs to set themselves up. And Bitcoin is ruthless like that. Like, it's going to teach everybody opportunity cost. I keep saying this. Bitcoin is going to teach the world opportunity cost, because it'll always just be there for you. There's that website, DCABTC, and here's what you could have made if you had just been stacking sats, if you had just been putting your coins, putting your fiat into Bitcoin, and here's how much you could have made. And, you know, you can go and you can try all sorts of things, and then you're always going to go back and compare it to stacking sats, and most likely you're going to come up short. So, you know, learn from the mistakes of others. But, you know, most people don't like to learn from the mistakes of others. They love to learn from their own mistakes. So, you know, go ahead, make your own mistakes, and send us a postcard if you can still afford it at the end.
and people need to, you know, you got to use very low money to see if it's for you. For example, I don't bet on sports anymore. I used to bet on sports, but Bitcoin taught me a valuable lesson. In my early days, like, one of the reasons I even bought my first Satoshis was to do some online gambling, because it was kind of illegal where I was living. And I learned a valuable lesson when I, you know, put in a big bet on a game, and my team won, but they didn't cover the spread. And I didn't lose much. I only lost a few hundred bucks. But at the time, and I'm not going to say the value of one BTC at the time, but it was like, I remember just thinking to myself, what the hell am I doing? This thing could be worth thousands of dollars one day, not to mention the 27,000 that is now. And that was the last bet I ever made on a sports game. And this was over 5 years ago. So, and I learned, like, what am I doing? Like, I'm not gonna be a sports bettor, and I'm just gonna lose more Bitcoin. And I realized that very, very early. So I'm buying my first Bitcoins in order to do online gambling. And within a month or two, I realized that I'm an idiot. Why am I gambling? And the same thing goes for people going to a casino. You know, you go, you have some fun, you lose some money, and you're like, well, I'm not doing this for another year. As long as you don't lose too much when you go in. And trading could be the same thing. You know, you got to start really small if you're going to do it. And as long as you learn real quick, this is not for you, that's the best lesson you'll ever learn. Just like I learned with that bet back in the old days.
Yeah, the curse would be getting lucky at the beginning, and then you're just, you're stuck being high on your own farts for the rest of your life and trying to recreate the magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So now, getting rid of all the warnings, let's just go ahead and be reckless and talk about Bitcoin and trading Bitcoin. So what do you think about Bitcoin cycles, Bitcoin prices moving forward? How do you see the price evolution? You, for those who are not very familiar with Tone, gained a lot of notoriety during 2019, because in early 2019 we had a massive bull market where in January the price of Bitcoin was around $3,000, and then it shot up to about 13,000-14,000 by, I think it was July, wasn't it?
June, July,
and then it came crashing down, and it kept crashing all the way until March in 2020 when it went down to 3,000. So while it was shooting up initially in early 2019, Tone earned the wrath and hatred of most Bitcoiners by constantly being the party pooper telling them that Bitcoin's going to crash. And indeed it did crash, and it crashed quite badly, you know, from 14 to 3,000. Everybody had thought, you know, the bear market was over and we're off the moon, and yet we weren't. So first of all, why did you think that was the case back then? What makes you think that there was a reason for it?
So for me, it felt like the bear market, while it certainly hit pain points as far as price, falling from 19, almost 20,000 down to 3,000, it met all the metrics of enough pain of a bear market price-wise. But I felt that time-wise, it needed to last longer than 1 year. And just based on that alone, I was very skeptical of the rise. And I will be the first to admit, I was almost ready to give up and admit I was wrong, and COVID might have helped me out. But my view of the market was that there
was... No, but the crash happened way before COVID. The crash happened in summer 2019.
Not all the way down to three. Not all the way back down to three. That one wasn't that bad, and then we went back up to 10. But I was still somewhat skeptical on that because of time. But when that second crash, when the COVID crash hit, I became a bull right then and there because that was a very painful price point. Yeah, I'm looking at the chart. From 14, we came down to about 6.5. And then from there, we went up back to 10, and it looked like it was all over. I was still a little bit skeptical, because now I felt that the fall from 14 to 10, while it was good enough time-wise, because that took about 4 months, now the overall bear market being a year plus all of 2018 plus 2019, already going into October, November. Now time-wise, we made it, but that second correction from 14 to 10 wasn't big enough price-wise. So now the dynamic is in reverse. Now my price didn't fall low enough the second time around, but time-wise we were okay in the overall bear. And then COVID just reset everything. The crash in March fell back down into the $3,000 range. Now the entirety of the bear market lasted over 2 years, all of 2018, all of 2019, and into 2020, into the first quarter of 2020. Granted, the second price low was not as low as the first price low a year and a half earlier, but it was close enough to it. And at that point, that's when I finally became a bull. And now I've been a bull since then. And what people have to realize that in a bull market, you should never short. There's nothing wrong with shorting in a bear market, even though on an asset like Bitcoin, you still shouldn't. Shorting is dangerous in general, but if you're going to short, you have to do it inside a bear market. We were in a bear market for 2.25 years. That was plenty of time to try to find points to short. Doesn't mean you were going to be profitable on those shorts, but at least they were shortable. Since March of 2020 this year, Bitcoin is never shortable. You either buy it, if you think it's overheated, you can sell it and you can try to buy the dip. People sometimes misunderstand trading. There's multiple types of trading, and a lot of people think that trading is a zero-sum game, but when you trade futures, it is an absolute zero-sum game. In the futures market, for every dollar someone gets, someone else loses a dollar. This is how gold and oil and Bitcoin futures work. The options markets are also a pretty zero-sum game. But in something like Bitcoin, it's not really a zero-sum game, because not everyone that sells loses. You're missing potential opportunities, but you're not actually losing value. So in a bull market, you can still trade, but you should never short. You can try to buy the dips. You can try to sell the highs to try and buy lower dips, and you may outperform Bitcoin's returns. Most people don't. Some traders do, but you should never short. And now that we're in a bull market, I would never ever mention the word short. I might sell. I might say, hey, I'm selling this top, trying to buy lower. But you also have to keep in mind that when I do that, And I did that recently. I sold the $19,000 top a little while ago, waiting for $14,000 dip to buy. The $14,000 dip never came. And I'm not waiting for this $14,000 dip. I bought back in around the same price I sold at when it came back to that $19,000. So in my case, I didn't really lose much. I don't know, maybe I lost like $200 or $300 on the price of Bitcoin because I bought a little bit higher. But I took my shot at buying that $14,000 dip and we didn't fell low enough to it. But I felt comfortable doing that. Felt smart at the time because Bitcoin did fall from 19,000 down to 16. I was just waiting for a little bit more. And if not, I was going to get back in at the same price I sold at. But that's trading. That is the slight risk that you take. But now that we're in a bull market, you should never look for shorting opportunities. And eventually this bull market is going to end. And hopefully when it ends, those that are even trading on a larger scale, if you choose to do that with a small part of your portfolio, dollar cost average is always good. You'll just keep buying the dips all the way up. But in a bear market, in a 2018 bear market, I was shorting in some cases, and they were not bad trades because we were in a bear market. So you have to understand what market you are in, and right now we're in a bull market.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, well, some people might say it could be a bull market forever, but it may be not. And so it's obviously easy in hindsight to wait until it collapses and say it. But with foresight, how would you, looking at what's happening with Bitcoin, if this bull run continues to run for another few months, what do you think in terms of risk management? What should people be doing? Is there a top that people should be looking for? Should people start selling? Because I think, you know, I definitely believe dollar cost averaging is the way to go. And I think trying to time the market is a pretty dangerous thing for most people to do. Yet having said that, if you're sitting on enormous gains because Bitcoin has been rising for the past 6 months and you're just stacking and there are very high gains because the value of the Bitcoin that you're holding has appreciated to the point where that has become life-changing money, you can't just, I think it might not be very wise for people to just continue to, you know, play the HODL fundamentalism and just think, you know, we're going to stick to the plan of just continuing to HODL until it goes to the moon. Because, you know, if you find yourself that you've stacked enough to have life-changing money and it's been rising a lot, perhaps it is a good case to be selling some because it might crash very quickly. So, for instance, look at the last two previous bull markets. You know, if you had held Bitcoin for a couple of years before 2013, and then at 2013 you went from, in the space of a year, we went from $10 Bitcoin to $1,000 Bitcoin, basically going 100-fold. You know, at that point, you could have had pocket change in Bitcoin, and then you could have been putting in pocket change, and then it became life-changing money for somebody. And I think at that point, you know, if you just continued to hold, you would have witnessed an 80-90% drawdown to follow over time, and all of that life-changing money would have gone. So same thing happened in 2017. What do you think moving forward now? How should people think about this bull market in terms of if there is more appreciation, when if there is more appreciation, should people be thinking about liquidating some Bitcoin? Should they sell some, or do you think maybe take loans with Bitcoin as collateral? What do you think?
You know, I'm still a little iffy on loans with Bitcoin as collateral, only for short-term things. So someone brought up this idea the other day, for example, mostly due to tax kind of gain. So, for example, if you wanted to buy a house, and I completely agree with you, Saif, eventually you want to upgrade your standard of living. Eventually. So if Bitcoin has gone up enough, especially if you're seeing it, like rise exponentially and you're ready to upgrade your standard of living, that is probably a good time to do it. So like right now, for example, I am looking at a potential short-term top around this $28,000, $30,000 area. I think we can have one more push higher. And then I think we will take a little bit of a break. Now we are still in a bull market. You see, because I missed my dip from 19 to 14, I think we are gonna dip towards the vicinity of 20. Now I could be wrong again, but I am looking to take some profit here and trying to time another top. And then I'm gonna try to time another dip at 21. And if we don't fall that low, I'll probably get back in at 30 so that I don't actually lose anything. But that's also because I'm disciplined and a bit experienced in trying to do that. But as far as loans go, you know, I don't really recommend going into debt to purchase Bitcoin, because that could also be a little bit dangerous. You can lower your, if you need Bitcoin so badly, you can lower your standard of living and try to acquire Bitcoin. But, you know, the stories of people maxing out their credit cards, you know, taking out a loan, a big loan. I mean, I guess if you take out a loan on your house, it's not that bad. And maybe it's better than selling your house, as long as you have fiat income to then pay for that. But you know, taking out credit cards, or if you're surviving on your Social Security, putting that Social Security check into Bitcoin, like I think that's my definition of scared money being invested, and you're gonna panic at first sign of trouble. So I don't recommend that. If you need to put your Bitcoins to use and you wanna upgrade your standard of living, a neat way someone said that, someone recommended to do that is, put your Bitcoin up as collateral, even on some of these sites that offer it. Take out the big loan, use that loan to just buy the house, and then immediately take out a home equity line of credit on that house and pay back the loan to get full control of your Bitcoin back. And you can get this done in a matter of weeks. But now you were able to leverage your Bitcoin, buy a house without liquidating the Bitcoin and taking on the tax liability of selling the Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is probably a good idea. And I think ultimately, you know, the Pierre Rochard speculative attack article, which was written many, many years ago, and the Michael Saylor current real speculative attack undergoing, where he's just borrowing endless quantities of fiat dollars and using them to buy Bitcoin. The logic there is impeccable. I mean, you want to be the responsible person that says, you know, borrowing debt is bad. But the way that the fiat system works is, and I'm writing the fiat standard right now, and in the next chapter, I think, you know, one way to think about it is that with all other forms of money, you know, the object of the form of money is to collect as many as possible, like whether it's gold or silver or Bitcoin, you know, everybody's trying to get more of it. But in fiat, that's really not a winning strategy. Like, you don't win the game of fiat by collecting more fiat points, because as Michael Saylor says it, you know, fiat money, cash, is a liability. It's depreciating. It's going to take wealth from you. And so collecting more of that isn't the way you win. The way you actually win is to try and collect the biggest negative balance. So the way to win with fiat is to manage to borrow more and more, because every time you're actually borrowing with fiat, you're helping the lender create money for you. And so when the lender is able to create money, he's happy and he's able to pass off some of the benefits from money creation to you. And that's why basically everybody buys their home and credit. It doesn't matter how rich you get. You know, the richer you get, the bigger the loan that you take. But if you tried to do it old school by just holding cash and being rich and collecting a lot of money and sitting on it, you won't be rich for long, because the money would lose its value. And so what people do is borrow against hard assets and use the hard assets as collateral instead of holding on to money. And I think, you know, with Bitcoin, this strategy is beginning to seem more and more compelling because, you know, in the fiat world now, interest rates are so low that it's plausible for people to get very low interest rates.
I'm just not a fan of that practice. I'm really, really not. Maybe it's because I like the way I grew up, like money, and I'm still, you know, I'm kind of like you. I'm pretty low standard of living. And I've never like been in credit card debt. I paid off the college loans immediately. I was always prepaying my mortgage. I just don't like the mental feeling of being in debt, even though it's fiat debt. And I know that it's, you know, immoral what they're doing with the fiat system, but I would never recommend it. And it maybe it's just my mental barrier that I shouldn't like leverage everything to the gills and just not care and buy Bitcoin. And I've been a little bit critical of Michael Saylor of, you know, buying up all that Bitcoin, but it's just, you know, criticism. It's not anything like I wouldn't force him to, you know, stop. It's a free market. He can buy as much Bitcoin as he likes, but he has to understand that, you know, Satoshi is still being demonized, even though he doesn't even exist anymore, for having a large chunk of Bitcoin. And there were even rumors that the guy after Satoshi had way more Bitcoin than Satoshi. The first guy that started mining with graphics cards after CPU cards, just such as a huge advantage on Bitcoin mining, that he had like a giant chunk of Bitcoin. And he realized that having such a huge chunk of Bitcoin would only hurt the future of the Bitcoin ecosystem. And rumor has it, he was doing everything he can to spread this Bitcoin around, like buying $10,000 pizzas, you know, 10,000 Bitcoin pizzas or whatever. I don't think that was him, but that was someone else from the early days. So these people in the early days realized that what's the point of Bitcoin if I have it all? And
Michael Saylor is not even at, is around 0.2% or something. So he's nowhere near coming to having it all.
No, I know, but it's the, he's not, but it's also perception as much as it is reality. And the perception is, and I've already seen it from people, well, what's the point of me getting in if this guy is buying it by the billions? And it's a free market. He's welcome to do what he likes. But in a way, like, for example, if someone like Elon Musk decides to get in with billions of dollars, you know, tens of billions of dollars. And this is also another way how my biggest concern is too much Bitcoin under a single government regulation. Like, we already have GBTC with a ridiculous amount of Bitcoin. Now, that's not owned by a single person. That is owned by tens of thousands of people, but it's still regulated by the US government. You have Coinbase with custody of a lot of Bitcoin. You have Gemini with custody of a lot of Bitcoin. You have Fidelity with custody. And all of these entities combined have a significant chunk of Bitcoin under the control of the US government, technically, because just like in 1933, when the order came down to confiscate gold, it was very simple because most of the gold was sitting at the banks. And the government just took it from the banks. And my concern is that if 40, 30, 40, 60% of all Bitcoin is sitting in custodial accounts under the control of a single government, or if a few governments, you know, got along and got together, you know, in one day, in one weekend, they can confiscate 40 to 50% of all the Bitcoin. And that could, you know, shock the system pretty damn badly. And that's been my concern. And right now, even if a single person, like if Michael Saylor is buying it for himself, I would feel more comfortable with that because he can leave the country. His personal Bitcoin is not under the control of the government. But if he's buying it on behalf of the company, then that Bitcoin is certainly at risk of confiscation in a giant, you know, executive order like the 1933 order by FDR. I don't know what your thoughts are of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that more centralization in this regard does increase that risk. But there is the counter argument or the counter force to this, which is that even though, yeah, we do get more centralization, once it goes mainstream like this, that actually makes it less likely that governments would act in this way, because ultimately, when it becomes an important part of the financial system and really influential parties in the financial markets are have a good stake in it, it becomes much harder for governments to move against it. And I think it's the kind of Trojan horse aspect of Bitcoin, I think, is underestimated, and that people join Bitcoin for the NGU, and you know, for the number go up, they join it for the financial aspect of it, but then they become vested in its success, and they somehow start wanting it to continue to succeed. So we've also seen, you know, if you study the history of politics and money and banking under the fiat system, you'll see that it has generally been quite possible for financial institutions to subvert government policy for their own interests. So it isn't as if, you know, governments are out there persecuting bankers and the financial system in order to help the population. They're doing it to help themselves, if anything, but primarily, you know, the power of special interest groups in the financial sector is, I would say, has proven itself quite effective at getting the regulatory treatment that it wants. And so this becomes a factor that is helpful to the spread of Bitcoin, because it makes it less likely that governments would clamp down on it. But yeah, you're right in that it's all under one jurisdiction. Having said that, the fact that it has become a regular asset like this makes the question of confiscating, or that it's become a regulated asset, makes the question of confiscating it really not very different from confiscating dollars. And so, you know, when your average third world kleptocratic government decides to confiscate bank savings for whatever stupid reason their president has decided about, the financial markets will make them feel this for decades to come. You know, people are just not going to trust sending their money to that country after they do it. And so even if a specific bank manages to confiscate, a specific bank or country manages to confiscate a lot of Bitcoin, they've just essentially doomed themselves not to be getting more capital coming in. And so that opens the door for other jurisdictions to become, to have more favorable laws on Bitcoin regulation, which can then lead to better, you know, which can lead to capital moving there. So I think it might be that the cat is out of the bag. You know, I don't want to be too confident about it, but I certainly see your point, but I can see the counters for why the cat is out of the bag, and it's too late for anybody to try and ban it now.
Yeah, but as we see with COVID, I don't want to get too political or too conspiratorial, that, you know, a few countries can force their agenda upon the entire world. And you're seeing that with COVID, where if a country or a region decides to, you know, not enforce the lockdowns or the mask mandates, you know, they get that phone call from the highest end of, you know, like the US government or the European government, and they put like significant pressure on those countries. Like in a recent Edward Snowden interview, I'm not sure it was an old Edward Snowden interview, I just watched it recently, where the question was that people are concerned that because he's in Russia, that he's somehow, you know, selling secrets to the Russian government. And his answer to that was, well, I didn't really want to be in Russia. I was in Hong Kong. I had to get out of Hong Kong. And he's like, I reached out to dozens of countries with no extradition, like France and some of the other countries, asking if I can live in their countries. And he said that either Vice President, I think it was Biden at the time, or Secretary of State, what's his name, John Kerry, called those nations and said, if you let this guy in, and give them safe harbor, you're going to face serious, you know, consequences from us. And they all said no. They're not going to let them in. So it's that's another concern that for now, the United States does have a lot of power, and not to mention all the bribes, like you saw with the last the $900 billion COVID bill, which had almost nothing to do with COVID and Americans, all this money to foreign nations. And that's how they bribe them to do what they want with U.S. dollars. So the unless the U.S. dollar actually falters, which I never thought was possible. I think you and I had those debates in the past where I did not see any way that the U.S. dollar would crack and go into hyperinflation until 2020. The election of 2020 has completely flipped my view of the imminent, and by imminent, I mean within a decade, the destruction of the U.S. dollar, which I did not even thought was possible. I had no, I could not foresee what can cause the U.S. dollar to crack, but that was it. And that was the loss of confidence of Americans and the world in the U.S. election process. And I think that is that and all the money laundering laws is what's going to potentially destroy the dollar by the end of the decade.
Yeah, well, I would say I think maybe even more significant was the economic devastation from the COVID crisis, because I think the impact on balance sheets across the U.S. and across the world is going to be enormous. Yeah, and I wasn't much of a dollar collapsitarian, and if you know that in my next book, you know, I discuss and in my talk that I gave in your conference, I spoke about how I think Bitcoin does not need the dollar to collapse, and Bitcoin doesn't necessarily lead to the dollar collapse. In fact, Bitcoin can be the way in which we manage to orderly disband the dollar effectively. But getting back to Bitcoin, I'm wondering, what do you think, what are your thoughts on the Bitcoin stock to flow model? We've had the Plan B here before, we've spoken to him. What do you think about it in terms of explaining the variation in prices in Bitcoin and in terms of using it as a tool for trading?
I'll just come out and say it. I'm not a fan of using that model as a tool for trading at all. I love the idea of stock to flow as I read it in your book. And it's great, but it's great as a concept. It looks like it's following his actual, chart model of stock to flow. But just like many PhD financial engineers, like I was, I mean, I have a master's in financial engineering, not a PhD. I'm not really a quant, pretend to be a quant, not really. I work with quants. Like a quant model doesn't look like that. And I just, look, I think it's great, but as a tool for trading, like any quant is actually bothered by that model. That's not how a quant model is made. And this definitely should not be a tool for trading. It might be a good tool for dollar cost averaging, but you don't really need it as long as you understand the general concept of it. So I like it as a concept, but I just don't like it as an actual model to be followed.
Now, that just sounds like a bitter no-coiners talking about new Bitcoin being just, you know, that's not how we do currency. You sound a little bit like, you know, well, this is not how we do trading, and therefore this can't work. Like, it's you have to see with me that this will trigger my my bullshit meter.
Sure.
Because, you know, yeah, it's not like how traders look, but that's no excuse for why it should be wrong. You know, there's the old example of the high jump, that historically people used to do the high jump head first, and then one guy came and did it by jumping the other way around, by jumping back first, and then it turned out to be better. So just because it's different from how everybody doesn't mean that it's wrong. So let me share.
Well, I'm not saying it's wrong.
But I mean, it can still be useful for trading. Like, if you think about this model, and I've just pulled it up on the screen. If you look at what we've seen, like the model came out early in 2019, right here, and the price at that time was around 3,000-4,000. So the price was on the lower edge of the first standard deviation. So it was one standard deviation below the expected price, which is kind of a, which was about 50% of the price. So the price at that time was expected to be around 8,000, and the price was in fact 4,000. So this guy had come up with this model saying, no, actually the correct price now should be double what it is right now. And right after he comes up with it, the price creeps up to get exactly where he was, and it overshoots it a bit, comes close to overshooting it toward one standard deviation more than the price, and then it comes back down again, and then continues to oscillate around that line for the next year and a half. And then even when you get the coronavirus crisis and an entire global liquidity crunch and everything is selling off and the whole world is falling apart and Bitcoin has no central bank and no lender of last resort, and what happens? We go from being exactly on the line at the expected value of around 8,000-9,000 at that time, and it crashes all the way down to one standard deviation away from the line, and that's it. And then it whips back and then touches the line again, and then that's when the line begins its rise because of its because of the halving. And then right after the halving, a few months, it begins to rise beyond the expected price, and now it's just basically hugging the line. So I'm not a trader, I don't trade, but I think about this often, and I think, you know, if you'd spent the last couple of years based on this model, selling when we're close to the selling, well, last couple of years you wouldn't have been selling, you would have had to be selling the years before, but if you had it for the past few years, you know, it would have massively outperformed simple hodling if you had tinkered your hodling or simple stacking, if you had tinkered your stacking so that you stack less when the price is higher than the predicted, significantly higher, and you stack a lot more when it's significantly lower. I think, you know, you could massively outperform just simply hodling if you keep the price target of what the model says in mind, and then trade inform that as you stack. And what do you think?
Well, here's the thing, right? Is there, there's two things that always concern me about these types of projections and models. So a lot of these regression lines, even they adjust historically. So every time this model gets adjusted, I need to like compare every one of these models that he's ever done, which I have not. And this is where I don't want to state something incorrect. And this is where I hate like regression models, because they always fit the line with the latest line. Like, for example, I'm not a big fan of TA, technical analysis, that can change historically back in history. Like my favorite TA tools are the ones that whatever it said yesterday, whatever it said a year ago, that will never change. It was either wrong a year ago or it was right.
Yeah, well, I mean, here you're effectively, in the last couple of years, you're not changing the model significantly with all the added data. It's helping make the model more precise in its estimates, maybe, and reducing the range of uncertainty around it. But the predictions have been, the predictions for what is coming in the future have been the same for a while. So if you ran this model with data that is only up to early 2016, you'd still get something that would tell you that, you know, we spend the period between the second and the third halving, the last 4 years, we'd spend them somewhere around the range of $10,000, and that we'd spend this, yeah, we'll spend the next 4 years around the range of $100. And so that's the case,
right? But say,
it changes every month with new data. It changes, and it can change a little bit when you change the specification, but you're still ending up on the same.
It looks better. Well, here's a prime example. Look, I don't know the details of the model, but if you look at the next leveling out, right? You see a leveling out just a smidge above $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost a straight horizontal line for 2+ years.
Yeah.
It's got a little slope, maybe, right, exactly. Maybe it goes from 100 and 1,000 to 105.
Well, but it doesn't really matter the precise estimate because you have a very big range for the first standard deviation.
I know. But I bet you that if he did this model back in 2016, there would have been a similar flat line that you see right now for 2 years around, you know, late 2017 into 2019. That straight flat line could have been at a dip, would have been just as horizontal. It could have been in a different area, but that line has adjusted. So if you take a screenshot of this and you see that line from the middle of 2021 up to the middle of 2024, and you go back to this chart in the year 2025, that straight horizontal line just above 100,000 may look nothing like that. That line could look more like the non-horizontal line that you see in 2013, 14, and 15.
No, I'm sorry, Tom. That's completely mistaken. Let me explain to you why.
And
I'm sorry.
When that
about
line
it.
Changes,
no, it no, no, no,
like don't. A perfect bounce off of two standard off of the standard deviation little peak.
Nope. So what's going on here is this line is basically the predicted value of the price based on the stock to flow. So this line is just a simple transformation of the stock to flow. And the reason it is flat here is because the stock to flow with the next halving cycle, so from 2021 to 2025, the reason it's flat is because the stock to flow has become so low that it's not going to change materially because the new supply is very small. So the stock to flow in 2024 is very close to the stock to flow in 2021. That's not the case between 2020 and 2018. Because in 2018 to 2020, you've added about 4% every year. And so the supply in 2020 is significantly larger than 2018. So the stock to flow changes a little bit. So that's why the line is sloping. And that's why it's sloping much more earlier. So the fact that it becomes flat here is just the fact that there's no more change in the stock to flow for these longer periods. But it's really, so this is kind of in my mind an inconsequential little detail. Well, maybe it's not inconsequential because maybe that's what this is showing us, is that we're going to get more stability in between halvings. But I think what is more significant is just the fact that this error, this large range of error, and I think people are taking it as if, well, okay, we'll get a bull run. And people are saying, well, we'll get a bull run, but the model doesn't hold. But if we get a bull run and we end up in this blue range and this model has held, you know, a model that you could have generated in 2019 or 18 or 17, and run the data for it and would have predicted the range for the date for the price in 2020 and 21, 22, 23. So here's, it's absolutely amazing, I think, in my mind.
I got another question. Like, when did he first do this? Because
March 2019 is when he released it.
Right. So I just don't understand the logic behind putting that line at 101,000 dollar price of Bitcoin. Like, how do you know that? And this is where my, I guess, humility as a trader tells me not to assume that we're gonna level out with 1 to 2 standard deviations around 100,000. It could be 50,000. It could be 300,000. So
okay, well, I guess you should look at the methodology. But essentially, it's just doing a regression between the stock to flow and. So you estimate the relationship between the stock to flow and the price for the earlier data, and then you project it forward. And the interesting thing here is that, you know, people do a lot of analysis based on, say, trying to do regression analysis on indicators. But the interesting thing here is, for instance, you could do an analysis where you're looking at the size of transactions or the number of transactions or the value of transactions that are being conducted every day, or the number of addresses or the amount of money on exchanges or the number of exchanges or transactions on exchanges. All of these are metrics that you could use to estimate price today, and you could develop a relationship. But the problem with them is that you don't know what these metrics are going to be like next year. So you don't know what on-chain volume is going to be like next year, so you can't estimate price from it. But we know precisely what stock-to-flow is going to be next year. And so if we have an estimate of a relationship built on the stock-to-flow, then we know what the relationship is going to be predicting next year. So this has been the case from early 2019 that the model has been out there. But even if you had done it before early 2019, you could have run it and you could have gotten similar predictions to now. And so I think this
And this is what I mean. Like, I love the concept of stock to flow, but I just can't connect the dots into projecting what price Bitcoin will be at based on stock to flow, because the main driver of Bitcoin is not stock to flow. It's speculation on Bitcoin, which is affected by stock to flow.
Yes, but we can have all sorts of theories about the why and what and who and where. But as long as the price continues to fit with this, I think the onus is on the haters to put an explanation for why it sticks to it. Because at this point, if you're saying that this is spurious, it's as if I'm telling you, look, this is a perfectly legit DAI, and I'm rolling it, and 90% of the time it lands on a 4. And you're trying to tell me that this is just a basically fair DAI, and I'm trying to tell you no. You know, where if I told you this DAI had landed 90% of the time, it had landed on a 4, and now you have to bet on this DAI, what are you going to bet, you know, for the next throw?
I'm going to bet on the 4, but again, this is, like I said, I don't have a problem with stock to flow. I just find it hard to connect the dots to identifying what price Bitcoin would be based on stock to flow.
Yeah, well, that's what the regression does, so we'll see.
Right, and this is why I don't like regression models predicting the future price of an asset based on past history. This is where, once again, I look at time and price and what's happening in the big macro picture.
So what are your expectations for the next bull run? Do you see us, first of all, do you see this running for longer? How much longer and how far longer? Do you have estimates? And how do you base that?
I am pretty damn bullish right now. I mean, Bitcoin will always overheat and it will pull back. But because of what I've seen, now you mentioned something earlier where you see the potential, you know, worsening of the, I guess, the fiat currency because of the shutdown. I actually take the other side of that. I think because of the shutdown, people are so broke because they lost their businesses. They're trying to save every dollar they can, and they still believe in a dollar. Like, no matter how much money the government prints, they can't print enough because they've destroyed more value than what they're printing back into the system. If you destroy $10 trillion worth of capital, printing $3 trillion is not gonna cause inflation because you're still down $7 trillion in capital. What causes...
You haven't really destroyed $10 trillion of capital in that case. You're referring to destroying $10 trillion of essentially financial assets.
Well, financial assets, future...
Not physical capital. But we have had actual real destruction of physical capital this time. We had a lot of businesses go out of business.
Right, exactly.
Destruction of capital.
Real estate prices going down in major cities. That's loss of your value and capital. I think the real driver for Bitcoin this year and into next year, and Michael Saylor is the perfect example of that, is the loss of faith in the dollar. I think that's the bigger part here. And I think the elections and many people's view, I'm not gonna say what my view is, but it should be obvious. Many people's view of the way the election went down is making people lose faith in the American political system, which makes them lose faith in the US economic system, which makes them lose faith in the US currency. Now, it's not gonna happen overnight, but I think that is going to be a big driver. So I think the main driver into Bitcoin is because people are gonna start to lose faith in the American, I guess, political and economic system. And because of that, I am now a lot more bullish than I was before, as well as people's understanding that some of the other collectibles aren't as safe. If the government continues on this quest for Bank Secrecy Act and FATCA and FBAR and all these money laundering regulations. And Bitcoin becomes a perfect asset for most people. And I think this speculation is going to drive Bitcoin. I see the market as more of a double bubble. Like in 2016, 17 was one big bubble, mostly 2017. There weren't any major breaks, but 2013 had two exponential rises. We went from $10 to $200 to $50 even in the first quarter of 2013. And then we fell from 250 down to about 50 bucks in the second quarter. And then in the fourth quarter of 2013, we went up from about 100 all the way to 1,000. So we had a two 10x rises in 2013 with an 80% fall in between. And I see a slight depression of both of those situations. I see this current run-up to be pretty significant. I think it has a chance to go to something like 50,000 or above, giving us that, you know, 5%, 5x exponential rise, not 10% like we had in 2013, 10 or 20, whatever we had in that first bubble. And then maybe not an 80% correction, but something like in that 40 to 50% range. But then immediately followed by another big rise. So I see one of these, just Bitcoin is just going up and it just got overheated and it falls, but it doesn't enter a prolonged multi-year bear market like we did in 2014, 15, and then 18, 19. I see it more as a maybe 3 to 6 month short correction and then immediately into a much bigger wave. So I can certainly see, I can envision Bitcoin topping the first time around in that 50 to 100 range, falling back down to 20. And then within the next 24 months from now, making a more significant top, you know, quarter million and above. I can totally see that. And to me, the biggest driver of that is the loss of faith in the American political system, which reflects in its economy. And not only by Americans, but also by, you know, the rest of the world.
I see. Well, that is, yeah, I think it's interesting that you have the two bubble perspective, but I think, well, do you think we'll still get a big crash after that? Or do you think Bitcoin has grown up and there will only be corrections, no more crashes? Are we going to see another 80% or are these days gone?
You know, I think the 80% might be gone. It really depends. It depends how fast it rises. The faster it rises, the bigger the fall. So if we're lucky, that second bubble that I'm envisioning that does take Bitcoin to a quarter million, it would drag out into the next halving. And then we can avoid a crash altogether. If that second run-up from, let's say my theory holds true, let's say we go to 50, 60,000, and then we have a 50% correction down to 25 or 30. And by the end of the same year, we're coming back into 50,000. And then the move from 50,000 to quarter million doesn't happen in less than a year. It happens over the next 2 years, 2.5 even. And it takes us into the next halving. We can avoid anything over 20% correction, because then the next halving, based on that, your next stock to flow, would take us right into another move up. But going back to that stock to flow, I just don't understand the logic or I'm not betting on the fact that Bitcoin is going to hover around 100,000 for 3 years within.
No, but you see that range is enormous around it. The one standard deviation is about from 50,000 to I think around 200,000. So that's what the model, it's not making a precise prediction that it's going to be 100. It's going to be between 50 and 200. And that might sound like it's a cop-out. Well, that's such a huge range. But no, it is not, because the Bitcoin price can be anywhere from 1/10 of a cent to $100 million. And so if you specify it on its way from, you know, if the model can guide us all the way from $200 Bitcoin all the way to a $1 million Bitcoin or whatever, and it continues to predict it, it's incredibly precise, even with a range as wide as 50,000 to 200,000.
No, and I don't have a problem with that range. That range can be from, you know, 50,000 down to 200 to an extra 50,000 below to 100,000 above. I just can't you know, plan anything based on the center of that line being at 100.
No, absolutely not. But I mean, I think where this is interesting is that if we find ourselves, if you take this model seriously in your risk assessment, then if we find ourselves on the second layer, you know, in the second standard deviation or outside of that, so prices at 300 or 400 and 500, this model would suggest that we're due for a massive correction. And so if you have life-changing money on you and you take this model seriously, and you know, you don't think you can stomach an 80-90% drop, this model would suggest that maybe you should diversify out.
Yes, and I would say that it's not about the price, it's about how it got there, like how fast or how slow it got to that price, and how much time. Well, I guess that's the same thing. It's not about the price, it's about how it got there, in what kind of momentum and what kind of speed and what kind of political forces and economic forces got it there. So it's possible that 200 could be in line for a massive correction of 80%, but it's also possible that hitting 200 and it's just getting started, and you just don't know until it's happening.
Yeah,
absolutely. And hopefully you know when it's happening, but even that can be tricky.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, all I'm betting on right now is that I've been a bull since the COVID crash, and I'm remaining a bull for now. And what happened, you know, the COVID thing is, to me, the COVID thing balances each other out. The money printing is a boost to Bitcoin. All the money printing that they did this year is certainly favoring Bitcoin. But all the capital destruction is favoring, you know, hoarding. And when people are broke, the last thing they can do is invest in a speculative asset like Bitcoin. So I think the COVID, you know, all of the benefits to Bitcoin of COVID are negated by the downside of the global shutdown and people being in very bad financial position and depressed and stuck at home. You know a lot about that because you're very, you know, anti-lockdowns, probably more so than me, and I'm pretty damn anti-lockdowns. And but the election and the political side of the situation is only one-sided and favoring Bitcoin, no matter who the president is, and it's looking like it's going to be Biden. That is 100% push into Bitcoin and the continued, you know, assault on financial privacy by you know, the developed nations, Canada, US, Australia, most of Europe. So that is just a huge push into Bitcoin. And that is what's making me really bullish Bitcoin, not COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll see. I mean, I would conclude by saying that, you know, this is kind of speculation about risk management, but my advice to everybody is to just, if you're into Bitcoin at all, you don't have to worry yourself about this. If you just stack sats for the long run, you'll be all right. There's no scenario. Well, of course, there are conceivable scenarios, but I think it's almost, Bitcoin is almost guaranteed to work out really well if you accumulate slowly. And that's really what I strongly recommend to everybody.
And also, by this point in time, like, I expected Bitcoin to have a way higher dominance over the shitcoins, which we didn't have time to get to. And I still think that's coming. So right now, Bitcoin is only at 70% dominance versus the shitcoins. You're seeing the big Ripple exit as it's being delisted from all the exchanges. And I think the SEC is only getting started. So that's another wave of, I mean, if you're exiting your shit coins, eventually you're going to realize the only thing worth holding is Bitcoin. And God forbid if anything happens to Tether, you know, if the government goes after Tether and actually shuts it down, that's another huge boost to Bitcoin. I think Tether is, a lot of people think that Tether has been what's pushing Bitcoin higher because they're printing Tether out of thin air. I don't see it that way. Now, it may be true. It's probably not, but it may be true. But even if true, someone is holding, you know what, billions of dollars in Tether. And if Tether starts, and if there are rumors that Tether is going to get shut down, you know, everyone's going to start selling that Tether at 10 cents on the dollar. And what are they going to buy with it? Of course, they're going to buy Bitcoin. So there is another giant wave that can push, you know, that can take Bitcoin like liquidity right off the market, the exodus from the shitcoins.
Yeah, but you know, we've had many false dawns about the exodus of shitcoin, but you know, you can't kill what is dead. They keep coming back. I think overall, you know, with the shitcoins, you see that in the long run, they all flatline against Bitcoin. They're all heading towards zero against Bitcoin. But individual shitcoins head like that. But collectively, they just keep coming up with new ones. And there's always new ones. And there will always be people that think that, you know, you're diversifying. And there will always be people that think, you know, Bitcoin's already too expensive. So there will always be a constant churn of shitcoin and shitcoiners profiting from them. But I don't think you should be too concerned, and I don't think it makes sense to even compare those two and put them in the same dominance index. And it makes no sense in the same way that, you know, you don't put tech companies with Ponzi schemes. It would be like including Madoff in the FANG or in the S&P 500, just different categories.
Well, obviously I agree with you. You shouldn't like rank them together, but unlike Ponzi schemes, in this case, people are actually holding those shitcoins, and they can exit those shitcoins as long as someone else is willing to buy them. And we are looking, if you look at Twitter, there's, I don't know how serious these people are, but there's like a hundreds of people tweeting about how they're looking to buy more Ripple on this dip. So you're right, the stupidity is there. And yes, Ripple is insane, but if you're holding Ripple, you can certainly exit Ripple. That's why the price is going down, because they are still like really easy. The liquidity is not high, but it's really easy to get out. In the case of like a BitConnect scam, like there's nothing to sell. That was an actual scam. But these things, people kind of believe that they're useful, which they're not. And they do have a quick exit out of them. So while we really should not be looking at Bitcoin dominance, the way I look at Bitcoin dominance is that is 30%. Of market cap in crypto that will eventually move into Bitcoin. And that's a lot of Bitcoin that isn't really available for trading, because if 30% of the crypto market cap is sitting in stupid, if it panics into Bitcoin, only 10% of Bitcoin supply is sitting on exchanges. So we're talking 30% of crypto market cap. So if you compare that value is going to dry up quick, but still, I mean, that's a lot. Like if there is a fault in Ethereum and all the Ethereum bag holders suddenly start converting into Bitcoin, that can shoot the price of Bitcoin through the roof. And we don't know when this black swan for shitcoins is going to happen, but it will happen.
Maybe, you know, I've thought about it before, but, you know, I would tell people not to get their hopes up too high and not to bet on it too much, because I think one other thing is that, you know, when you say 30% of the market cap is Bitcoin, okay, maybe, but 30% is shitcoins, but, you know, to make a dollar more on Bitcoin's market cap, you need somebody to hold a dollar extra. Like you need a Bitcoin holder to have a dollar extra and not want to sell it. But to make an extra dollar in the shitcoin market cap, you need a few cents of marketing material effectively. So shitcoin money, you know, to create shitcoin liquidity is not very difficult. You create a big supply of coins and you trade a small amount of it and you can make wash trades and then you can suddenly make it like you have a very large volume. But it's not like, you know, you can make a shitcoin have $1 billion in volume with a few million dollars of volume, with a few million dollars of money.
Right, but someone is still holding that giant bag, even if it's the scammer that created it. And I see,
But I mean, he's only holding it because he's doing all of the song and dance in order to keep it propping up the price. But if he tried to sell it, it would come crashing down. So the point is, if you do have that accident, if you do have that black swan where all of that money wants to go into Bitcoin, it's not going to be 30% of Bitcoin. It's not going to be 30% of the crypto market cap right now. It's probably going to shrink to something much smaller.
Right, but see, I'm surprised you're going this direction because this is like a perfect, like kind of like a Trojan horse here. See, I would go the other way. Like, look, guys, dollar cost average as much into Bitcoin as you can and hold every Satoshi because this black swan is coming. And when it does, it'll double your price of Bitcoin. And you can keep saying it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. Just hold more Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a win-win, Safe.
There are endless reasons to hold Bitcoin. And so this is definitely one of them. But yeah. Well, Tone, this has been a great. Thank you so much for joining us, and this has been quite informative.
Yeah, one is asking any questions.
Yeah, they did ask a few in the chat, which were.
I'm looking at the chat, at like the Zoom chat. I don't really. They're asking them just to you because they're asking them only to you.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, Tone. Have a good day.
All right. Awesome. Thanks, Safe.
Bye-bye.